expressed in this podcast are our own and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Department of Defence, the US Air Force, the US Space Force, or the Australian Air Force, or any other affiliate organisations.
Hello, and welcome back to another of the SAS Space Power Discussions. I'm Major Joe Regan, United States Air Force.
I'm Wing Commander Jenna Higgins, Royal Australian Air Force.
And I'm Major Caudill, United States Space Force.
In this episode, we are going to talk about a series of what is going on within the Spring 2025 Space Power course at the School of Advanced Air and Space Studies. Each discussion tackles a key topic in space strategy, and today we're diving into the 2018 publication of The Space Barons by Christian Davenport.
The Space Barons is a fascinating deep dive into the rise of commercial space and the individuals driving its growth. Before I hand over to Dylan to give an overview of the book, let me first define some key terminology that will help give some context to our discussion. Let me start by defining who's who in space today. There are three major players shaping the domain: the commercial sector, national security and defence space, and the civil sector, each with its own goals, incentives, and roles. According to the DoD's Commercial Space Integration Strategy, the commercial sector includes individual companies and organizations that develop solutions for commercial markets, bear significant investment risk, operate based on market incentives like cost control and return of investment, and have legal authority to offer those solutions. Now think SpaceX, Planet Labs, Blue Origin. Companies innovating quickly, competing for contracts, and driven by profit, not policy. When these companies offer products like satellite imagery, broadband from orbit, or launch services, they provide what we call commercial space solutions. And when the military starts using those services in its planning, operations, or architecture, that's called commercial integration. The key takeaway: commercial space is driven by market forces, not government mandates. Now contrast that with the national security space sector, led by the US government, particularly Department of Defense and the US Space Force. Their mission is pretty straightforward, but critical. They protect U.S. national interests, deter adversaries, and maintain space superiority. This includes operating and defending the GPS constellation, missile warning, space domain awareness, and projecting combat power in, from, and through space. These functions are inherently governmental, not profit-driven, but focused on national defense, strategic advantage, and deterrence. The key takeaway: defense space is about sovereign control, military dominance, and security. And then there's NASA, often confused with both the commercial and defense space sector, but fundamentally different. NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, is a civilian federal agency. It's not a military organization. It's not a company. Its mission? Scientific exploration. Think Mars rovers, space telescopes, planetary science. Human spaceflight, like the Artemis moon missions, and Earth observation for climate sciences and disaster response. NASA exists to advance knowledge, not to generate revenue or conduct warfare. It's governed by public interest, pursuing discovery, diplomacy, and education. NASA openly collaborates with international space agencies, encourages commercial partnership, but it doesn't launch military satellites or operate defense systems like missile warning or GPS. That's firmly the DoD's domain. The key takeaway: NASA serves science and society, not markets or militaries. So a quick recap: commercial space sector, driven by profit and innovation, i.e. SpaceX, Planet Labs. Defense space, driven by security and sovereignty, think DoD, US Space Force, and NASA, driven by science exploration. They're a civilian space agency. Each has a distinct mission, but increasingly they have to work together. Now, with that out of the way, I'm going to hand over to Dylan to give our listeners a quick summary of Davenport's book.
Awesome. Thank you. So, again, the book was written in 2018, so it's missed a few years at the end in recent space developments, but it does a very good job setting the foundation of the growth of commercial space exploration and exploitation starting in about 2000. One of the things the book recognized very early on, and it was actually noted and quoted by Andy Beal of Beal Aerospace, a defunct space company now, but that there would never be a private launch industry as long as NASA and the U.S. government chose to subsidize launch systems and essentially create a false monopoly, preventing other companies from coming into that sphere. This book gets into it pretty early on. In September of 2000, Jeff Bezos founds Blue Origin with the intent of getting into space, creating that space access platform. And then soon after that, Elon Musk incorporates SpaceX. So that's 2000, 2002. And then immediately it gets into anecdotes regarding how they went about that, some of the issues they ran into, the competition that was between the two companies as they're going about their business, They take different routes. SpaceX is very aggressive. They're willing to fail. A lot of people compare them to the hare versus Bezos' tortoise. He's so bold even to stick little tortoises on all of his space vehicles now. So he accepts and appreciates the comparison. But you get into that, you get other wild characters like Richard Branson. All these charismatic, I think is the nicest word, billionaires that want to get into the space industry, either for esoteric pleasant reasons because they want to explore space. A lot of these guys cite the 60s and 70s space exploration efforts of NASA as the thing that got them interested in the subject. And then underlying that, I think there's an enthusiasm for making money and kind of advancing that industry. So as you go from like the early 2000s into the late aughts, like you see 2010, President Barack Obama visits with Elon Musk. There's plenty of photos showing that. And you can start to see both the anecdotes and then just generally the growth of these companies and the industry as a whole, that commercial space is becoming something greater. It's actually getting its foot in the door. It's starting to be used by the United States government as an alternative to traditional companies like United Launch Alliance, and even kind of nudging up against NASA for some of its roles and what it provides to the state. And then you get further into the book, they continue to compete with one another. There's actually some Twitter battles that you can read throughout the book that are fun to read. I don't know that they've aged well, especially considering how much Twitter, I guess now it's X, has become a little bit more notorious than it was in the early 2000s when everyone just thought it was a cool way to share pictures. So then you get into 2014, 2015, you start to see the success of Blue Origin. They finally caught up a little bit. They're doing more launches. They're having these vehicles return back to Earth, which is a novel experience or a novel concept. SpaceX immediately jumps on that. Now they're both competing in that industry. And a lot of the advancements that you're seeing here that really were kind of missing prior to the introduction of commercial space is that competition is driving innovation. Open innovation is kind of the catchphrase of these fellows. Like they're having to make money, they're having to compete, and that's making them do things that risk-averse associations like NASA and even the DoD in some cases, it's just simply unwilling to do. There are side anecdotes about Richard Branson, his spaceships. Obviously, he's doing some pretty aggressive things as well. There's a lot of discussions of space tourism that are in the book. In terms of strategy and what we discuss in SAS, that's not nearly so prevalent, but at the same time, it is a competitive thing that they're doing, and it has caused them to not necessarily take risk, but to take chances in the development of some of these systems. So it's just still pushing it along. And eventually you get to the end of the book, and essentially everyone involved really like doubles down on the fact that a lot of what they're doing here is to get to the moon, to get to Mars, and to advance humankind. And that's really kind of the summary of the book. So that's the high level. But Joe, what stood out to you?
Thanks, Dylan. One of the biggest takeaways for me was just how tough really breaking the commercial space industry is. These pioneers, these barons faced three things here. They faced financial, technical, and political hurdles. But before we dive into how they tackled those, I really think our listeners need to understand the inherent difficulties of space itself. And for those turning in, the Air University Space Primer is a great reference for understanding the basic terminology and environment of space. The Space Primer goes through such things as environmental factors, such as solar radiation pressure and gravitational influences from the moon, sun, and other planets that make maneuvering in space extremely complex. These forces impact everything from launching rockets into orbit to operating satellites once they are there. Another big thing the Space Primer talks about is orbital debris, often referred to as space trash, is another major hazard. This includes everything from micrometeoroids to man-made debris from defunct satellites and anti-satellite missile tests. Today, over 500,000 pieces of debris are actively tracked to protect both national and commercial assets. These are the kind of obstacles nations have traditionally faced when putting space-based capabilities on orbit, obstacles they tackled with billion-dollar government budgets, funding, development, and operations. That's why it's so remarkable that now we live in a world where commercial companies, not just nation states, are building and launching space systems, often with capabilities rivaling or exceeding government efforts. But this shift didn't come easy. As Christian Davenport outlines, commercial space companies had to overcome enormous barriers just to get a seat at the table. One early example, as Dylan mentioned earlier, Andy Beal, who founded Beal Aerospace in 1997, a billionaire who made his fortune in real estate and banking. Beal wasn't your typical aerospace engineer, but he saw an opportunity to offer space launch services at a more affordable rate and disrupt what was then a heavily monopolized industry. He invested $200 million of his own money into the venture and successfully tested a rocket in 2000. But despite his technical progress, Beal faced strong resistance from both NASA and the Department of Defense. Neither believed in his capability, nor were they willing to invest, creating both political and financial roadblocks. In the end, Beal Aerospace shut down. Another figure Davenport highlights is Elon Musk. Like Beal, Musk saw space launch as both a business opportunity and a way to advance space travel for humanity. He founded SpaceX in 2002, and like Beal Aerospace, the company initially struggled to gain support from government agencies. No one was interested in handing over their space launch responsibilities to a private company. But unlike Beal, Musk didn't back down. In 2004, despite advice from his colleagues, SpaceX filed a complaint with the Government Accountability Office, arguing NASA's contracting process was unfair to commercial competitors. The result? NASA was forced to recompete the contract. It was a rare victory, but one step in the uphill climb. Even with a foot in the door, SpaceX still had to prove it could deliver. Its first-generation rocket, the Falcon 1, faced serious technical challenges. From 2006 onward, the company suffered three consecutive launch failures, even after winning government contracts. These failures showcase just how difficult it is to achieve reliable space launch, even with funding. In the end, stories like Beal Aerospace and the early SpaceX make it clear, breaking into commercial space launch required navigating intense financial pressure, overcoming technical failures, and pushing through political resistance, none of which is guaranteed, but those who succeeded helped redefine what was possible in the space industry. But beyond that, Davenport clearly wanted to raise public awareness. He is writing not just to inform, but to inspire. Jenna, what can we learn about the importance of public awareness when it comes to the space domain? What were your thoughts?
Yeah, great question, Joe. And I find this topic really, really interesting, the idea of public perception. So public awareness is a crucial part of the puzzle, and without it, you lose momentum, funding, and long-term interest. So let's go back to some of the books we've read about through the course and start with the foundational voice in space strategy, Everett Dolman, the author of Astropolitik. Drawing from Mahanian theory, Dolman argues that a nation's ability to become a true spacefaring power depends not just on technology, but on the character of its people. He describes what he calls an astropolitical society. That's a culture that embraces long-term vision for space exploration, even if that means sacrificing some social comforts to fund it. It's a society marked by national pride, a deep respect for science and technology, and a willingness to take risks. It needs a spirit of adventure and people ready to celebrate those who lead the charge. Now, he puts it pretty bluntly in his book. He says, if the society does not already incorporate these sentiments and attributes, it's up to the government to inculcate them and nurture them. That's how important he sees a spacefaring character is. And we've seen this play out before. So during the Cold War, the US government used the Soviet launch of the Sputnik in 1957 and the ensuing space race with the Soviet Union to build public enthusiasm. That competitive drive helped justify massive amounts of funding for the Apollo missions, ensuring the US reached the moon before the Soviets. But when the geopolitical pressures eased and the space race slowed, so did the public interest. And with that, congressional support for funding also went away. Now, fast forward to the early 2000s, and a new kind of space figure emerged. As Dylan's kind of already alluded to, and as you did as well, Joe, Elon Musk is a big name in this. Now, love him or hate him, Elon Musk has captured not only America's attention, but the world. He's done it through a mix of charisma, vision, and relentless storytelling, especially on social media. Now, his high-profile persona didn't just earn him followers. It opened doors in Washington and helped him break into the defense industry. As Christian Davenport recounts, in 2003, Musk bought his brand-new Falcon 1 rocket to Washington, D.C., hoping to make a splash for his fledgling company. SpaceX. He loaded the 7-story rocket onto a custom trailer and hauled it across the country. Now, with a full police escort, the rocket rolled down Independence Avenue right past the National Mall, a spectacle no one had ever seen before. He parked this space shuttle, what was effectively a missile, outside the FFA headquarters, and it drew curious stares from tourists on their way to the Air and Space Museum. But as we've already alluded to, this story isn't just about Musk. The Space Barons, we also follow Richard Branson and Jeff Bezos, two very different personalities, as Dylan's already alluded to, who each play a role in reshaping how the public views space. Branson, ever the showman, pitched space tourism as a thrilling adventure within reach of the everyday person. Bezos, more reserved but equally ambitious, launched Blue Origin with a long-term vision, expanding humanity's presence beyond Earth. Now, we also read a book on this course called When the Heavens Went on Sale by Ashley Vance, and this book captures how these figures transform public awareness. He wrote specifically that when billionaires such as Musk and Bezos come along, they pitched access to space as a noble, necessary quest that would fulfill humankind's destiny. They espouse the ideas that we are explorers by nature to ensure our species survives and thrives. That shift reframed space as more than just a government endeavor. It became a public-private mission fueled by entrepreneurship and ambition. Vance also highlights how companies like Planet Labs and Rocket Lab made space feel attainable, even personal. And as he put it, people all over the world, for better or worse, began to see themselves as the next Elon Musk. The rise of satellite constellations, Earth observation networks, and global broadband is shaping the Earth right now. And that kind of transformation demands a public that is not just watching but truly understands what's at stake. So the bottom line, awareness is only the first step. To keep that momentum going, we need to channel public excitement into opportunity and into the environment where the next generation of space entrepreneurs can thrive. That means fostering open innovation, healthy competition, and access to the tools and resources that can make the real breakthroughs possible. So with that, Dylan, what's your take? How is the commercial space sector doing when it comes to encouraging that kind of innovation and competition?
Thank you, Jen. No, it's interesting. They've done things that I don't know could have been imagined more than 20 years ago. The degree that we've increased our access to space through commercial entities is astronomical, to use a space word, or the space word of the day, I suppose. The number of launches that SpaceX can give throughout the week used to be something that ULA would hope for in a quarter or maybe even longer. When I was a launch officer myself, we were hoping for something like 8 launches a year. That was kept us pretty busy.
Wow.
At this point, it's hundreds of launches, and they're not straining to do it. It's something that they've been able to do organically as they've gone through this competition, driven not only through a need to outpace Blue Origin and these other competitors, but also just to get their foot in the door with the government. The government kind of resisted this initially. SpaceX and Elon Musk had to sue the government. It was quite the scandal at the time. A lot of people at the Pentagon got quite upset about it. But it was ultimately a necessary thing to showcase that they were able to provide space access in a way that the United States government needed it to be done. The competition, the need to prove themselves, and I think a general drive that's inherent in Elon Musk and some of these other billionaires, it's truly introduced some innovation that I don't know that we could have come up with in the past. When I used to work on expendable launch vehicles, the idea of bringing one of these back to Vandenberg Air Force Base would have been almost comical. But now at this point, like if you're not returning your vehicles back and reusing those first and second stages, or at least first stage, then you're not going to be able to compete. So I think, the proof is in the pudding, and these fellows have really done quite a bit to innovate, to make it affordable, to make it aggressively accessible, and to make it rapid, which is something that the United States needed to remain competitive and maintain our lead in space.
Yeah. No, so I think if we boil it down, I think we agree that Davenport's key themes, first, the challenge of entering the commercial space arena, second, the need to build public understanding and support, and third, the power of innovation and competition to drive progress. But as good SAS students, what critiques did you all have about the book?
It's probably just me, and I feel bad for saying it, but when it comes to billionaires, I tend to not hold them on the same level as some of these journalists and authors like to do. If you read this and you really get into it, it reads like a David versus Goliath. Everything was against them, and to some extent, they had a lot opposing them in terms of government bureaucracies, a lack of, I don't know, precedent for some of these things. But at the same time, there's a high degree of infrastructure. SpaceX didn't start launching out of Texas. They started launching out of Vandenberg and Cape Canaveral. Bezos got government money. Elon Musk got government money. These guys were sponsored, mentored, and brought through the system a little bit more than this book would imply.
Yeah, no, I think it's a good point, and I kind of agree. I mean, Davenport sticks pretty close to the big names. As we've mentioned before, Bezos, Musk, Branson. Meanwhile, as Jenna had mentioned earlier, you know, we had read The Heavens Are on Sale by Ashley Vance, which highlights the struggles of lesser-known startup companies fighting for survival in the same ecosystem. And you have to imagine, right, the giants, as we just mentioned, were, you know, kind of competing against government contracts. And now you have these lesser companies competing against really the big companies in commercial space. And so I think that was something that, you know, I think our listeners need to know is that people are, it's not just the big three. You know, for example, Rocket Labs is a new innovating company down in New Zealand who is competing with Space Launch and is delivering, you know, credible space capabilities to get stuff on orbit. Another company that we talked about was Planet Labs, who's really, one of the big successes is a satellite called the Dove, which is probably no bigger than a shoebox, and they're putting up hundreds of these things. And they're helping not just governments, they're helping local people, farmers. They're taking pictures of fields and showing farmers, hey, this is where you need to water your crops. They're able to, you know, help with climate change, saying, hey, this is where things are changing around the globe, and supporting really the humanity that I believe the big three are pushing towards. They're really pushing their assets towards really the average everyday citizen.
Yeah, I think you're right, Joe. And Davenport really does tell an engaging story, but there's a much broader and more diverse cast of commercial space than this book really reflects. So as we start to wrap up, let's kind of reflect back on what we've spoken about today and what's in that book and discuss some of our lasting takeaways. Do you want to go first, Dylan?
Yeah, thank you. So this is just the beginning to space commercialization. And to be fair, the first thing you have to talk about is space access. That's the launch, and these guys are in that business. They're involved. They're doing great things. But after launch is available to smaller companies, you'll start to see more exploitation of space, more commercial entities in space, and a general proliferation of this sort of business model.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, Dylan. And I think commercial space isn't a passing trend. It's a foundation to how we access and operate space, especially as we look at military space. Commercial satellites have made space more cost-efficient and agile, often outpacing government programs in developing and fielding new technologies. And, you know, we studied in the beginning of our course some of the policies and strategies of the U.S. Space Force and the U.S. government. I mean, commercial space is littered all over it. For example, the 2020 National Space Policy makes it clear, stating a robust, innovative, and competitive commercial space sector is the source of continued progress and sustained U.S. leadership in space. That sentiment is also echoed in the 2024 DoD Commercial Space Integration Strategy, which outlines a vision to fully integrate commercial capabilities into the national security space architecture. And their key priorities include ensuring access to commercial solutions across the full spectrum of conflict, achieving integration before a crisis occurs, establishing security framework that promote commercial collaboration, and supporting the development of new commercial space technologies. And to dive straight into what the Space Force is talking about, they released the 2024 Commercial Space Strategy, focusing on the four pillars of balancing government and commercial assets, ensuring interoperability between military capabilities and commercial capabilities, building resilience into the space architecture, and promoting responsible conduct within the domain. Altogether, these strategies reflect a fundamental shift. Commercial space is no longer on the sidelines. It's central to both innovation and national security.
Yeah, I mean, I think they are all really valid points. So I'm going to go back to what I talk away as like my main talking point from this book. And I think there is some really good applications for the future. So space really needs to become more ingrained in popular culture. There's no denying that the rise of commercial space led by visionaries like Musk, Bezos and Branson has injected new energy and aspiration into the space sector. We've seen incredible advancements in satellite development, launch capabilities, democratizing access to space. But here's the truth. Greater activity doesn't automatically equal greater awareness. And I'm going to give a shout out here to one of our SAS professors, Dr. Whitman Cobb. She wrote recently that, points to public knowledge and support for commercial space isn't nearly as widespread as we think it might be. Especially when you read books like this. So she writes that data shows that despite a shift in interest about space with the arrival of commercial space actors, knowledge about and support of commercial space is not as widespread as believed. That's a powerful reminder that while headlines and launches may grab our attention, deeper public understanding is still lagging behind. She goes on to note that this finding may be of importance for promoters of space exploration, both inside and outside the government, as it suggests that to increase support for space exploration, a much greater emphasis should be placed on public education. And I think she's absolutely right. So even as the new space movement grows, it still relies heavily on government support, funding, infrastructure and policy. That means public consent and ideally public enthusiasm still matters. So if we want space to remain a national and global priority, we can't just rely on tech innovation. We have to invest in public education, communication and trust. And finally, a note of caution. Much of today's space enthusiasm in the United States is tethered to a handful of cult personalities. That can be powerful, but it's also can be fragile. Public attention is fickle. And if our collective excitement depends on a few billionaires' charisma, we risk losing momentum when the spotlight fades or controversy around those billionaires occurs. So what's the bottom line? If we want a sustainable public support for space exploration, especially the commercial side, we need to build space literacy at scale, not just celebrity-driven fascination. Across the space syllabus, one thing is clear. We can't build a sustainable future in space without an informed, engaged public. From Dolman's moral imperative to Bowen's warnings about the hidden histories and Pajulik's call for global responsibility, space power starts with public awareness.
Awesome. Again, so that closes up for us. So thanks for joining us on this episode of the SAS Space Power Discussions. We hope you enjoyed our take on the Space Barons by Christian Davenport. Until next time, always above, semper supra.